Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. The Stand is proudly supported by Tesco. Tesco would like to thank customers for continuing to follow the in-store safety measures that help protect us all at this time. Now, more than ever, every little helps. Now, on the front of last Sunday's Sunday Times, there was a remarkable headline. It was called Disunited Kingdom. And the point of it was surveys in the other parts of the United Kingdom other than England, surveys in Scotland, in Northern Ireland and in Wales, which showed the extent to which there is a growing nationalism in the United Kingdom. And in particular, the Scottish nationalists and Nicola Sturgeon, their leader on the COVID pandemic management, for example, have differed from London. There is intense dislike for Boris Johnson in Scotland, and that is reflected in his poll numbers and particularly in numbers on how people feel he's managed the pandemic. I think 22% are satisfied with the way he's managed it. The rest aren't. And in our own country here, in the Irish Times this morning, Mary Lou MacDonald has a piece which is headlined, "The Government Must Persuade and Plan for a United Ireland." There is a rising nationalism, and it was reflected both in Mary Lou MacDonald's piece in the Irish Times this morning, the prominence of it, and in the survey done by the Sunday Times, which led the newspaper. We're joined now from London by Chris Johns. Chris is a Welsh man. He is former chief economist with the Bank of Ireland and writes a delightful column every Monday on page 13, the business section of the Irish Times, which is always engaging, delightful, and thought-provoking. Chris, the rise of nationalism is nothing new to this week or last week. Nevertheless, the findings of the Sunday Times surveys are thought-provoking, are they not? Because, and I think we both feel, Brexit has been an example of the rise of nationalism, English nationalism in that case, but it has kind of been the catalyst for lots of people to think about their identity.
For sure. And as you say, it's nothing new. It's nothing recent. It's something that ebbs and flows throughout all of human history. And the experiment, and I would call it that, of the United Kingdom, depending on your historical perspective, it dates to sometime in either the 1700s or 1801, the Act of Union in that year. And it's always come and gone in terms of an issue. Scottish nationalism has been around forever. To a certain extent, and a much smaller extent, Welsh nationalism has been forever. When I grew up in Wales, Plaid Cymru was a very minor party, and not them, but extreme Welsh nationalists used to burn holiday cottages of English visitors.
Yes.
So it's been around for a long time, but the lid has been kept on it through various methods, through various institutional structures. I mean, we need to remind ourselves occasionally of why the EU was founded at all in the ashes of the Second World War. And if you are familiar with the rhetoric and the documents surrounding the foundation of what is now the European Union, it was explicitly designed to put another lid or another nail in the existing lid of nationalism that had led Europe to catastrophe twice so far in the 20th century. And that is what the European Union was originally and still is designed to keep under wraps, because nationalism, once unleashed, is very, very difficult to put back in the box, because too many people, populist politicians in particular, and others, there are all sorts of interests that see an advantage to be gained from stoking the nationalist fire. Rich people who own newspapers like to do it, for example, here in the UK, a lot. The survey that you mentioned went out and asked people about whether they wanted a poll on independence, a border poll in Northern Ireland, independence for Scotland. They also asked the Welsh, and the results were fascinating because it shows this rising tide. It's not a slam dunk. It doesn't say definitively that if you held a referendum in Scotland today that they would, knock it out of the park and the Scottish Nationalists win. It was actually like the Brexit referendum, 52-48. So there's still an awful lot to play for. I'm astonished by my own country that I grew up in, Wales. A third of people either want a border poll or are thinking in a nationalistic way. And the trigger, the catalyst for this latest bout of nationalism is, I would say, the English nativism, not just nationalism,
yes,
that was unleashed by the Brexit referendum.
Yes.
It was one of those things that now out of the box is going to be very hard to put back, because one of the most sinister aspects of these surveys results, and indeed other discussions and other analyses of opinion, is that it's the people in England that worry me the most, because that release of English nationalism has led them, when asked, what do you think of Scottish or Irish independence or reunification? They kind of shrug and say, oh, I don't care. And it becomes financial as well, because people are dimly aware in some cases of just how much money Scotland and Northern Ireland in particular actually costs the British taxpayer. The English taxpayer, because that's who it is. If they reunified Ireland tomorrow and didn't pick up any of the financial tab, would be able to take a couple of pennies, 2 pence off their basic rate of income tax, given how much money they sent to Northern Ireland. When these sorts of very simple financial, simplistic financial statistics are bandied around, it's the English now, as well as the Scots and the Northern Irish and the Welsh, don't seem to be too enamored of their union. And I think the headline was right. It's a very disunited kingdom. And it was really interesting to see the immediate response of Johnson and co. in the wake of this poll, because they clearly have thought about it and they've started their campaign. And you actually even saw it at the health COVID press conference that was held yesterday from Downing Street with Matt Hancock in charge, because he played the United Kingdom card as often as he possibly could, particularly with respect to the vaccine, and saying that, you know, if we had a disunited kingdom, if we didn't have the United Kingdom that we have, we wouldn't be able to be having this fantastic vaccine program that's world-beating, world-leading, and very few countries are doing better than us type thing. So you can see the way this is going to go. They're going to play the United Kingdom card in the most unlikely of places, because I think they're running scared.
Yes, and we've just seen for 4 years in the person of Donald Trump what American nationalism looks like. And interestingly, I watched Joe Biden last night make what he considered to be a very important speech. And it was about America first, and America first in terms of trade and jobs. And this is unusual for a Democrat in this age, but it was certainly not a rebuttal of Donald Trump's American first and make America great again. Joe Biden was saying we have to create jobs for Americans. We can't be exporting our jobs. So the tide, if you like, of nationalism is swelling. And Mary Lou MacDonald's piece, prominently displayed in the Irish Times, not known for its fervid nationalism, shall we say, is interesting. I'm not a nationalist, so it doesn't really interest me. Well, it interests me, but I'm not going to take it up. One of her arguments is, Mary Lou MacDonald, that if anything ever proved the need for a united Ireland, it is the coronavirus pandemic, which is really quite an idle thing to say. Nevertheless, she's seizing on it. So there is a relevance here for all of us in terms of, well, let's just look at an Irish perspective for a moment, Chris. It's pretty clear, is it not, that Boris Johnson and his government, the way they've treated the Northern Unionists, the way they've really mocked the DUP, betrayed them, you know, on a whim, then embraced them again and betrayed them again. They don't give a damn about the unionists, do they?
I don't think they do. It's only when they need their votes in Parliament that they ever give any thought.
Yeah, the brief period Theresa May needed their votes.
And then at every opportunity, they renege on any deal that they may have done with the DUP. And it also has to be said that the DUP couldn't have played a worse hand. I mean, I'm not a great gambler, but I would love to sit down and play poker with some of those characters because I think I'd win a lot of money. They're hopeless at tactics and strategy when it comes to negotiating, and they couldn't have put Northern Ireland in a worse place. For example, if they'd simply taken Theresa May's first Brexit deal, Northern Ireland would be in a much better place. And their votes meant that she didn't get it.
Yes.
There wouldn't be a border in the Irish Sea. There wouldn't be all these stories we're seeing in various places about the frictions now for trade between the island of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. We wouldn't be seeing stories about importers of cheese in Northern Ireland saying, well, we're not going to bother importing it from Great Britain anymore because the paperwork is too much of a faff. The expenses are too great. We're just going to import our cheese from the Republic now. It's a small story. It's an example of what happens when you throw sand in the gears and wheels of international trade. There's an economic logic. There's an economic gravity that pulls you in a particular direction. And it isn't immediate, although in some cases over the last the first 3 and a bit weeks of Brexit, there have been immediate impacts. You can see the way over the next few years, economic gravity is actually going to be the force that reunites Ireland, because I suspect that little cheese example will be writ large, and that the economic connections, strong though they are already, are going to get even stronger between the two parts of Ireland, and that what will precede, maybe, I don't know whether it will actually ever happen, I suspect it will, but the political reunification will be preceded by economic reunification via trade between the two parts of Ireland. And I think that's the thing that the DUP has managed astonishingly to achieve.
Yes, Peter Shrimsley, who writes it, he's the political editor of the Financial Times, he wrote a brilliant piece last week saying the biggest driver of United Ireland and weakener of the unionist cause is the DUP. And he gave some very, very vivid examples of how the DUP is a driver in the cause. Robert Shrimsley, I should have said. Sorry, I'm cracking up here at the idea of Sammy Wilson driving the nation of Ireland together. I want to go back, though, to something much more serious. And that is the position vis-a-vis Scotland. Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg, two English nationalists, Johnson would deny it, two old Etonians. What could be more repellent to a Scot than two old Etonian clowns running their country from Westminster?
Certainly one of the biggest cards that the Scottish Nationalists have to play is simply allow Boris Johnson to open his mouth.
Yeah.
The old Etonian Bullingdon Club, classically educated Englishman, is Boris Johnson, is by all evidence in polling repellent to the average Scot. They just don't like him for obvious reasons. Culturally and politically, they see him as being from a different universe, not just from a different country. And he has a problem with his own persona north of the border. And I suspect that Scottish unionists will want him kept as far away from Scotland as possible. And they will have to have a different strategy. And similarly for Jacob Rees-Mogg, I mean, it's interesting that he's been kept away from things full stop, particularly during last year, the year before his general election. And you know, he paints a caricature. It's almost like he's becoming a parody of himself. He's remarked that the fish in the North Sea are now much happier because they're British.
Yes, and he is also, I remind you that, I'm sure I don't need to remind you, Chris, the leader of the House of Commons, which in many instances controlling Commons business is a powerful position to hold. But if we take this back, I mean, if you want to really upset unionists, you'd wave a picture of Mary Lou MacDonald or any of her Sinn Féin colleagues in front of a unionist. And we have on this island 1 million unionists, and their interests and their protection and must be paramount in the feelings of everyone on this island, in my opinion. But it's not widely shared. There is a move here. There is now a group called the Ireland Future Group, Ireland's Future, is a group who thinks that there should be, and Mary Lou refers to it in her piece today, we should be beginning a dialogue around the future of the island. Now, there's only one place this dialogue and conversation is leading. It's to a united Ireland.
Yeah, I think it is leading to that. And as I say,
it's not right, is it?
The way in which it will be done, it will happen. As I say, the economics will come first and will be followed by the politics. I think there'll be a further tightening of economic relationships between North and South and to be followed politically. But that will only happen happily, peacefully, in an equitable way. If we engage with the unionist community in a positive and constructive way. The problem with nationalism historically, and this is all nationalism in all the forms that it's taken, is that it always leads to trouble. If you start othering groups or countries or regions, it often leads to violence. The reason why I mentioned the founding of the European Union after the Second World War was that, by my count, that was the 17th time since Columbus decided to find an alternative home for Europeans disaffected by nationalism and founded the and fell upon the United States. France and Germany had fought 17 wars.
Yes.
This is real. And nationalism doesn't always lead to war and violence, but it often does. But 100% of the time, it leads to trouble. So if you pursue a purely nationalistic us and them approach to Irish unification, it's going to potentially be, I think, you risk a very ugly process. There's going to be good ways and bad ways of doing it. A reasonable model would, of course, be the German reunification model when the Berlin Wall came down. And even then, they made lots of mistakes. They got some of the economics wrong. Technically, the exchange rate between the two countries was done at the wrong rate, so that an awful lot of East German industry was devastated. If you are going to reunify the island of Ireland, you're going to have to think about those sorts of issues, because there are two currencies at the moment. You are going to have, presumably, the North adopting the euro at some point. The way in which you do that is going to be very important. The way in which you're going to handle the debts of Northern Ireland, the way in which you're going to have to handle the funding of Northern Ireland going forward, all of these things can be handled well or they can be handled badly. But if your prime driver of all of this is the nationalist question, all of those important issues get shoved to one side and get handled badly. And that will lead to post-reunification trouble of one kind or another. Hopefully not violence, but certainly economic problems, for instance, and therefore social problems. And, you know, you can choose to do it well or you can choose to do it badly. And if you hand it over to the nationalists to make all of the running here, you're going to do it badly.
Let me ask you about English nationalism as you experience it. You're a Welsh man, you're living in London at the moment. And I lived there for 17 years and I didn't have to happily socialise with the likes of Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg. However, the average English person I didn't find to be unduly nationalistic or unduly unpleasant. In fact, I thought many of them were pleasant. They were, in their own way, they talked fair-minded. And they weren't anti-Irish, as people assumed. They took you at face value, as it were. What is English nationalism, Chris? Is it a belief in the Queen? Is it a belief in the Commonwealth and Britannia ruling the waves? What is it?
It takes different forms, and it sometimes depends on where you are in the United Kingdom, where you are in England. And the problem is that it's something that, as I said earlier, it simmers below the surface and doesn't come out very much, but has been utterly unleashed by the Brexit referendum.
Yes.
If you spend, as the Brexiteers, 40 years othering Europe, continuously battering away at the English and explaining and proclaiming how awful European structures, institutions, and indeed peoples are, then you eventually, if you throw enough mud at the wall, some of it starts to stick.
And even in my sympathetic, as it were, lens on Englishness. There was always this thing about Johnny Foreigner.
Yes,
he dived, yeah. He cheated, he was not to be trusted.
It comes out in all sorts of ways. And before the Brexit referendum, it didn't come out very often, but it did come out. And as an ex-footballer, you'll know that every time there's a World Cup, the tabloid news, yes. The tabloid newspapers start printing front pages with Germanic-looking peoples in funny helmets and pictures of Spitfires. We can laugh about it now because it didn't. It was fairly, not completely. It was fairly harmless stuff. We upset our neighbours, but they used to look at it more with sadness than with anger. And you know, we made things like the famous "Don't Mention the War" episode of Fawlty yes. Towers. That's the way in which it popped out. We were able to almost laugh at ourselves with our seeming obsession with the Second World War and our past, really, rather than our future. But the Brexit referendum turned all that sort of gentle stuff, that mocking of yes. ourselves thing that we would do, into something far more sinister. And as I say, the Pandora's box was opened.
Can I ask you where Nigel Farage, who to me epitomizes or personifies rather the Brexit cause and the kind of English nationalism that lies at the heart of Brexit?
Yeah, Farage probably is the ugliest exemplar of English nationalism. A lot of people would say that his views were often bordering far too close to othering foreigners, racism perhaps, xenophobia certainly, and if you like, an actual hatred of things European. If you listened to the sort of things that he used to say actually in the European Parliament when he was an MEP, it was strong stuff, and he did manage to upset a lot of people. He wasn't typical of England, but he did represent one strand of English nationalism, and he increased the number of people that started to, you know, as I say, you know, he kept on throwing mud at the wall. He and his cronies in UKIP, in the British tabloid media in particular, but not just the tabloids, the people that own newspapers like The Telegraph. They see their own interests that start with nationalism, but also broaden out into their own back pocket, quite frankly, in stoking all of these fires. And you get all sorts. Another exemplar would be an MP called Daniel Hannan.
Yes.
MEP Daniel Hannan, who isn't Farage-like in his nationalism. It's more subtle than that, but ends up, I think, very much in the same place. And the extraordinary thing about that kind of nationalism is that the Johnsons of this world reward it. And Hannan, who is a subtler form of nationalism than Farage, was recently ennobled. He is now Lord Daniel Hannan,
yes.
For example.
Well, he certainly served the cause of Britain leaving Europe for a very, very long time while he was an MEP. He's the most articulate and in many ways persuasive of those who, within the Tory party, who argued for Brexit. The point that should be made about Farage is that he won a lot of election results. He won a lot of seats to the European Parliament. And in that process, I think they won 17 seats, Chris, or something like that, persuaded David Cameron and George Osborne, who's intervened in this matter in recent days, persuaded Cameron and Osborne that they'd have to hold a referendum.
Yeah,
so that was a critical moment. And
yeah, I think that's sort of right. I think just for the record, Osborne would say that he always argued in private with Cameron when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer not to hold the referendum.
Yes.
He was against it. But once Cameron called it, cabinet responsibility required that he row in behind it. As you know, Osborne is now the editor of London's Evening Standard, and he wrote, I think it was only last week, actually.
He did, yes.
An editorial forecasting Irish unity. So people in powerful positions think it's coming, which is why you are getting this reaction from Johnson. He doesn't care really, as you rightly say, about Scottish people, Welsh people, or the Irish question. I doubt whether he spends much time thinking about any of those things, actually. But he will be concerned about his legacy. The last thing he will want in the history books, because he is aware of history, as I say, he is a classicist, he will not want to be seen as the prime minister that allowed the United Kingdom to break up.
If he becomes that, it will be the end of his political career, it is said. What I want to ask you finally, Chris, about all of this, this is not something that is receding, dying down. This is something, and Mary Lou everything from Mary Lou MacDonald's piece in the Irish Times this morning to George Osborne's piece in the Evening Standard last week, to almost everything we see, is the change in Joe Biden from, you know, putting America first, and therefore responding to Trumpism. Everything we see means this is a growing trend. You refer to your home country, Wales, and only one third. It seems less so in Wales.
Yeah, because it always
has. Because is it because the Welsh are exceedingly nice people with the most wonderful, peaceful, beautiful national anthem?
We are a very nice people, and
somewhat melancholy people. I always thought.
The Welsh have a lot to be melancholy about, actually.
They are different from, say, as different from the Scots as you could possibly be. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. One of the great stories about the United Kingdom since 1801 is the way in which this multinational confederation union has operated successfully, which with very, very different peoples within it who have coexisted quite peacefully. I always remember when I very first lived in Ireland in the 1980s, early 1990s, having these nationalist type questions. I was curious about Irish nationalism growing up in Wales, where it's a very different perspective, or at least it was back then. And I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine from South Armagh, which, you know, is a tough place to have grown up in.
We know
in many
all
respects.
About South Armagh.
And he was asking me about that Welsh question that, in a way, you just asked me. And I explained to him that certainly me and anybody else in Wales that I knew was very happy in our own skins, being both British and Welsh. And he genuinely, despite, you know, he was an SDLP type, Seamus Mallon fan type nationalist. He wasn't anything more extreme than that. But even that mild nationalist just couldn't understand what I was saying about peacefully coexisting in my own head, being both British and Welsh. It just didn't compute. You mentioned Biden earlier, and I think it's important to explore that just for a second, because I think that he's made a big mistake with continuing Trump's America First policy, because, and this is from the economics perspective, I know politically why he's done it, because it's the thing that gains most traction with Trump-type voters. But the right way to have dealt with that is to say that globalization is net-net good. It brings lots of benefits to the United States, and the more globalized the world economy is, the better off the United States as a whole is. But what we've done very badly, all presidents before me, Trump and all the rest of us, is handle the winners and the losers from globalization. And what I'm going to do is allow globalization and trade to continue, because we do benefit as a country, but I'm going to take care of you if you actually suffer some of its downsides. That's the right way to do it. If you want to make America poorer, including the people that you want to help, then you deglobalize. And that's, I think, a real wrong turning for Biden. And I'm really quite worried about that.
Yes, I just say to you that he would have very much in his mind two things. One is Pennsylvania, Michigan, and those Rust Belt states that he needs and they need Democrats in future presidential elections, and also for Senate and Congress reasons.
So I'll put a question to you then. It's about honesty, isn't it? It's about saying to these people from Pennsylvania, from the steelworkers of Pittsburgh, is that it's not the Chinese or any other country that has snaffed your jobs. The empirical truth is that it's a technological change. More jobs have been lost to machines than to the horrible foreigner. And how do you speak that truth? How do you tell a coal miner the reason why your job is coming back, job isn't coming back, is because of the green agenda that we must follow to save the planet? I mean, somebody sometime is going to have to speak honestly to these people, not calling them deplorables. That's not the way to do it either. But it's A, speaking honestly, and B, then coming up with a plan to deal with the economic insecurity that they feel.
Well, I'm not equipped to engage in an economic argument with you, Chris, which is why I'm not going there. But at least we have established that Joe Biden isn't politically tone deaf, and we'll leave it at that. It's just a final question about Johnson. Things are beginning to slide away from him, are they not, in terms of the United Kingdom project?
Yeah, the United, I think that's the biggest threat to his premiership, not the virus, actually.
Yes.
Because when the history of it all gets written, if he can get the country vaccinated, and that's clearly the plan, and by the way, for the first time in the virus's evolution, Britain is doing something right. The vaccination program is going very, very well. The numbers that are being vaccinated on a daily basis are truly astonishing, actually. I actually had a look at a vaccination. I didn't get vaccinated myself, but I had a look at a vaccination center yesterday, and it's quite something to behold, the machine that has sprung into action, finally, to try and deal with this. If he gets the country vaccinated quickly and gets the coronavirus thing under control, that's what people will remember. They won't, at least the majority of people won't remember the earliest phase. So the winners write the history. So it's the UK issue that will define his premiership, in my opinion, not the virus.
Okay, Chris, as always, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and we're very grateful to you. That's Chris Johns. We're grateful to Chris, to you for listening. And of course, we're particularly grateful to Tesco, our sponsors. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon. The Stand is proudly supported by Tesco. Tesco would like to thank customers for continuing to follow the in-store safety measures that help protect us all at this time. Now, more than ever, every little helps.